You think you know the Caribbean? Turquoise seas, reggae and calypso drifting in the breeze, sun-baked islands bearing the illusions of paradise. But the true stories of these islands are neither gentle nor simple. They are forged in fire and hidden in the shadows, spoken in forbidden drum codes, encoded in lost languages, and buried beneath sugarcane fields. Generations fought, sometimes quietly, sometimes in revolt, against erasure, their triumphs and tragedies woven into music, masquerade, and memory. What if the voices you never hear are the ones who shaped it all? Whose memory survives not in history books, but in secret ceremonies, ancestral whispers, and the trembling beat of rebel drums? This isn't nostalgia. It's a reckoning with what was hidden to protect the living, and a resurrection of stories nearly silenced for good. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. For Whom the Drums Speak. Part 1. Midnight in the Maroon Hills. The night is heavy with the scent of guava and earth. A humid cloak wraps the slopes where the maroon community rests, halfway between oblivion and fierce remembrance. High above the plantation lines and colonial patrols, children press close to their grandmothers as the drums come out of hiding. Against the distant shimmer of fireflies, a fire burns low, the kind meant for storytelling, not for warmth. 9-year-old Jada watches her grandmother unwrap the goatskin drum from its oilskin covering, tracing her thumb along a winding groove carved by ancestors who defied both masters and time. Jada's heart thuds, partly in fear. She knows punishment for talking drum ceremonies can be severe, even since abolition. Every participant glances at the dark horizon, aware of eyes in the cane fields and ears on the wind. The elders begin, slow, deliberate, tapping rhythms that seem to ask permission from spirits and the forest alike. Each beat is a syllable, each pause a secret. The children learn to listen with their bones, not their ears. Tonight's session isn't only music. It is memory preserved, warnings disguised as lullabies, hope masked as celebration. Jada's grandmother nods at her, then at the drum. Taking her cue, Jada raises trembling hands and mimics the cadence. The sound is uneven, but the rhythm is ancient. An elder's cracked voice interrupts. The ones who cannot listen are the first to be forgotten. The ones who can listen are our salvation. Beyond the ring of firelight, unseen eyes mark the movement. A plantation foreman, sticky with rum and curses, mutters to himself. He hears nothing, only a faint, forbidden music rising above the trees. He spits and returns to his post, never comprehending the warnings echoing beneath the skin of each drum tap. Part 2. The Secret Language of Survival. Decades, even centuries, fall away. In the smoke and shadows, Jada's grandmother, called Mama Miriam by all, signals the start of a story. Once, she tells them, the drum was not an instrument. It was our messenger, our shield, our sword. The masters outlawed it, thinking it summoned rebellion. They were right, but not in the way they feared. She taps a slow rhythm, then faster. This means danger near. This means gather in silence. And, her gaze hardens, this is the call to run. Around the fire, the elders slip into a chant, words half in Twi and half in the language of the land long before slave ships came. Each drumbeat is matched by a code word. A boy asks, couldn't they hear us? Mama Miriam smiles. They heard the sound. They never understood the language. The children's eyes widen as she explains how, on moonless nights, the drums guided runaways, marking paths safer than speech, warning of patrols, announcing the birth of new fugitives in the hills. Not all who fled survived, but their stories thrived in rhythm and riddle. In the audience, Jada's older cousin, defiant, wounded from a fresh brush with overseers, presses his hand to the drum. The world out there wants us quiet. In here, we make our own world. Part 3. Forbidden Songs. Hours pass and the circle tightens as the beat deepens. The older women swap verses of songs declared illegal generations ago. Each note bends between lament and laughter. These are not the songs often sung for tourists. Some are laments for mothers lost to the Middle Passage, their names unspoken but not forgotten. Others are dirges for maroon warriors lost in skirmishes, eulogized before dawn by widows who wove their grief into sacred patterns. As midnight stretches, a young man begins the Song of Two Rivers, his voice cracked with fatigue and defiance. The children hush. Some words are never translated. Some melodies are crafted to twist away from ears that do not belong. These forbidden songs find their way into the soil, feeding roots that crack stone and make fruit sweet in the dry season. A sudden sharp note stops all conversation. An elder taps three quick beats, danger, real, or recalled. The fire is doused in a flurry, little ones bundled and sent to sleep. Adults melt into the shifting shadows, the drum rewrapped, the story hushed, a ritual of survival still as urgent as ever. Part 4. The Beat That Saved a Village. Later, in the darkness of her hut, Jada curls against Maman Miriam. "Why do we hide something so beautiful?" she whispers. Maman Miriam pulls her close, breath smelling of cane, spirit, and mint. "Because beauty is our weapon, child. The drum is more than music. It's history. It's warning. It's the road we took from slavery into freedom, and never the other way." She tells the story of a dawn when British soldiers marched toward the hills, hunting a rumored band of rebels. The Maroons had no rifles, just drums, courage, and the cover of forest. In the mist, the rhythm called to every ear, "Flee north by the river. The path is safe." Mama Miriam's mother fled that morning, given the seconds she needed by the code in those beats. The soldiers arrived at empty huts and dying fires, not a trace of the children or elders left behind. Some say the soldiers heard echoing drums for months after, and nightmares haunted their camps. That day, the music brought another generation, one more chance to keep the story alive. Part 5. Living Memory. The next morning, the sunlight scatters diamonds across dew-laden grass. Jada finds herself drawn back to the circle, replaying rhythms on her knee while feeding goats. She watches as Maman Miriam polishes the drum with oil, lips moving in silent prayer. Later, they sit together on the porch, the old woman teaching her three patterns: celebration, for weddings and harvests; mourning, for funerals and exile; and rebellion, for everything the world would erase. Jada learns that each rhythm sits atop another, like hidden writing in a palimpsest, and that the real messages are always for those who suffer most. When an outsider asks about the drum, Maman Miriam only smiles and tells him it's for celebration, never mentioning the fugitive in the cane, the missing child, the cry for freedom. To those who listen closely, every beat is two stories, one for the world and one for those who cannot afford to forget. Jada decides, right now, under a Caribbean sky, that she will always remember both. Chapter 2. The Island That Vanished. Part 1. The Cartographer's Lie. The dawn mist clung to the Caribbean Sea like a hush over a secret. In the cramped belly of a Royal Navy survey ship, cartographer Joseph Thornby shuffled through battered parchments, his fingers stained with sea salt and ink. The task was simple, he was told: update the master chart of the Leeward Islands. Yet, as he charted the outlines of familiar coastlines, his eyes kept drifting to an empty expanse, one the locals refused to discuss. His journal, bloated with water damage, revealed frantic notes, visited cove at dusk, unmarked graves, children with eyes like storm glass, elders won't speak of southern spit, fear, palpable. Thornby learned to keep his curiosity quiet, for every question seemed to stir glances of warning or ancient sorrow. On his last night ashore, an old woman crossed his path in the marketplace. She pressed a small carved stone into his palm. "Not all islands are meant to be found," she rasped, her accent rolling from Creole to shreds of forgotten tongue. Thornby wished he'd had the language for her blessings or warnings, but the meaning was unmissable. That evening, he inked a single careful line across the parchment, then let the sea air smudge it before it reached the ledger. The vanished island would not become another imperial claim. Its absence was a silent rebellion, a testimony to ancestors and spirits determined not to be conquered, not even by memory. Part 2, Survivor's Testimony. Generations later, the legend of the lost island hung in salt air over neighboring shores. Names faded from official records, but remained etched in story and song. On a crescent beach sheltered by mangroves, children helped elders build boats the old way, canoes lashed with breadfruit fibers, sails sewn from flour sacks. As night dampened the sky, they gathered around driftwood fires to listen. "Once, we could see their signal fires on the horizon," Grandfather LeBeau began, his voice carrying above the crackle. "On stormy nights, the spirits would drum warnings against the rocks." The tale was always the same. After a burning season or imperial audit, the fires vanished and the island fell away from all but memory. Aunt Nicole, her arms dusted with flour, spoke of dreams where the lost island's people visited at dawn, faces familiar, yet marked by exile. "In the wind, you hear them calling. Remember us. Name us in your sleep." Her eyes shone with a mix of grief and pride. Children swapped stories of late-night swimmers who returned changed, or the fisherman who found a carved stone in his net, much like the one the cartographer once received. Some said the vanished ones walked among them during carnival, masked in silks and laughter, speaking the old language no one dared write down. For these descendants, silence was both a shield and a form of remembering. Each generation learned the boundaries not by map, but through the hush that followed certain stories or songs cut short by the arrival of outsiders. Part 3, Rituals of the Vanished. The lost island was not empty when it was erased. Archaeological teams, decades after Thornby's voyage, attempted to unlock its past with satellite imagery, shallow digs, and sonar scans. What they found frustrated their expectations. Runs of stones upright like teeth, bones twisted into ceremonial patterns, ashes mixed with lime and coral sand. One research team, led by Dr. Estelle Markham, interviewed villagers about recurring dreams. Over a table scattered with stone artifacts, they listened to a frail man describe a vision. "My ancestors wash up on the reef with baskets of maize and tobacco, their feet bound. They are welcomed. They build a council ring. Then one day, boats come, red sails, storm voices. There is fire. And then nothing." Markham's assistant, Marcus, pressed gently, "Do you know what happened next?" The old man closed his eyes. "We do not speak it, but we keep the drums. In every drum, there is a hollow for one stone from the buried ring." That night, Markham attended a clandestine ceremony. Drummers, faces daubed in ash, pounded rhythms that rose with the moon. The pulse crested and broke like surf, echoing into darkness. Each beat said the same thing. "We survived by refusing to become history." Part 4. The Stones Remember. At dawn, the archaeological team walked the beach littered with strange stones. No GPS coordinates could pinpoint the vanished homeland, but the symbols on the rocks, spirals, interlocking lines, depictions of fish and birds, hinted at a whole cosmology. To outsiders, it was ancient graffiti. To the locals, each stone was a surname, a prayer, or a forgotten hero. One stone, unearthed on a new moon, bore a carving of a canoe crossing waves. The village healer, Ma Colette, insisted on returning it to the water, speaking a blessing in a slipstream of West African and Carib syllables. That afternoon, a squall swept across the bay. When the storm cleared, fresh markers dotted the sand, as if the sea itself was returning lost names for the living to remember. Part 5. The Map's Hidden Truth. Years later, a battered journal and a carved stone sat together in the archives of a northern university, a curiosity filed under folklore, unattributed. A graduate student traced the faded script, whispering the story under her breath, sensing the gap in the global story. Meanwhile, on the island's opposite shore, descendants gathered for another all-night drum circle. Children watched the firelight flicker over faces drawn with charcoal. At midnight, the eldest among them tapped 3 beats on the drum, just as their ancestors had on nights when the sea itself seemed to rebel against the colonial world. No one spoke the vanished island's name aloud, but in music, in ritual, and in every generation's birthright to remember, the island endured, never surrendered, never mapped, never truly lost. Chapter 3. Bloodlines in the Sugar Fields. Part 1. Cane and Chains. The air in the valley is thick with the sickly sweetness of ripened cane, humming with the songs of grasshoppers and muffled voices. Every step between the furrowed rows stirs dust and memory. A young woman named Amara walks the boundary of her great-grandmother's plantation, running her fingers over the old stone wall, cool and pocked, built by vanished hands. Even now, generations later, she feels the weight of their presence pressing through the morning mist. Stories in her family say their history began not with birth, but with capture. Ancestors wrenched from West Africa, packed like sorrow into the bellies of ships, emerging as little more than shadows beneath a Caribbean sun. They built this land by force, and in resistance, made it home with every breath and prayer. Each harvest song Amara hears among the stalks carries both grief and bone-deep joy, the twinned inheritance of those who survived the impossible. On festival days, the elders gather along the riverbank with baskets of plantain and saltfish, retelling their lineage's journey in parables and riddles. The children, legs swinging from the dock, listen to tales of a proud matriarch named Sessi, who, legend claims, used her lullabies both to soothe her children and warn other enslaved families of danger. "You are here because someone hid you in the cane," Amara's mother says, voice trembling with reverence. "Remember them when you walk these rows." Part 2. Freedom Papers. Beneath the floorboards of her grandmother's home, Amara discovers an old trunk crusted with brine. Inside, layers of cloth protect brittle papers and rust-pocked shackles. She unfolds a certificate of manumission, weathered script granting a single ancestor her freedom for a sum earned through years of secret night markets, traded herbs, and healing. Other papers are less clear, charred and torn. Some are lists of names, mothers and sons, each noted by weight and age, some crossed out in hasty ink. At the bottom, a line, "Disappeared, presumed escaped." Amara's heart aches as she lifts a scrap with a faint thumbprint, a mark left by a great uncle who led a midnight group of fugitives into the swamp, never to be seen again. At the back of the trunk, wrapped in a cloth dyed with hibiscus and indigo, is a small wooden figurine, the Adinkra, symbol for endurance. Amara clutches it, feeling both proud and sorrowful, haunted by the knowledge that every generation's freedom is built upon another's risk. She brings the trunk to her grandmother, who weeps softly at the sight. "These are our freedom papers," she whispers. But freedom was never just a document. It was the will to survive when survival seemed unthinkable. Part 3. Legacies Unbroken. Night falls on the plantation, the air buzzing with the call of cicadas. Amara joins her grandmother in the ancestral garden, planting rows of okra and sorrel by moonlight, just as her foremothers did, each seed a defiant act of remembrance. The stories flow freely here, of runaways who built hidden settlements in the hills, of healers who used forbidden herbs to keep hope alive, of secret weddings when all seemed lost. Every harvest becomes a ritual of affirmation. As the women gather yams and cassava, they recount the tale of Kofi, an ancestor who sang so beautifully that his captors let him play for their gatherings, unaware that each song masked a coded message for escape. The children giggle at the idea, but the elders nod, knowing these stories hold more than legend. They carry the crooked map of a people's persistence. After supper, the family assembles by the sugar mill's rusting gears. Amara's grandmother holds up the Adinkra figurine and recounts, for the 100th time, the words spoken by Sisi as she led her children from bondage. "We are not defined by what was done to us, but by what we choose to keep alive." Beneath the stars, Amara feels the strength of every ancestor settling beside her. The wounds are not gone, but the legacy, the unbroken thread of survival, music, and memory, is more powerful still. She knows, in that quiet moment, that every untold Caribbean tale is a drumbeat echoing through time. Persistent, proud, and utterly unyielding. Chapter 4. Carnival's Secret Codes. Part 1. Behind the Masquerade. Tropical dawn spills gold onto narrow city streets, scattering confetti and the last embers of carnival torches. For the uninitiated, carnival appears as pure spectacle, a delirium of feathers, sequins, and thunderous steel drums. But for those rooted in the island's history, masquerade is never just entertainment. It's camouflage. It's code. In the heart of Port Royal, costumer René Demong sits cross-legged on a rickety veranda, a bolt of purple cloth pooled at her feet. She carefully stitches cowrie shells into a mask patterned after ancestral deities, recalling stories her great-grandmother whispered before sunrise. Every bead is a message. Every mask is a shield. Renee's mother, Miriam, arrives balancing a tray of plantain fritters. "Don't forget the feathers," she says, running her fingers over the headdress in progress. "The first jab-jab dancers, our greats, they used wild bird plumes and mud, not sequins. The true rituals, they both know, are older than empire. They predate even the word carnival, stretching back to African rites, maroon rebellions, and moonlit gatherings forbidden in the time of their ancestors." As dusk approaches, families descend upon Renee's yard, each child wriggling into hand-me-down velvets, faces streaked with charcoal, eyes fierce with anticipation. Tonight, they're not just parading. They're participating in a centuries-old game of resistance disguised as revelry. Part 2. Banned and Reborn. A century earlier, colonial magistrates and plantation owners viewed carnival with suspicion and fear. Edicts were written banning obscene noise, drums, African dances, and indecent masquerade. The authorities feared uprisings, rightly, as carnival often served as cover for secret gatherings, encoded messages, and the transfer of news across guarded boundaries. Oral tradition holds that even as laws tightened, the MAS remained irrepressible. With every ban, we created something new, an elderly band leader, Uncle Cyril, explains. If drumming was outlawed, we used bottles, bamboo, tin pans, every kitchen became a band. If masks were forbidden, we painted our faces. If gatherings were policed, we danced in alleyways and sang riddles as lullabies for the children, but warnings for those who listened. Renee and Miriam unpack old trunks filled with faded photographs, each freeze-framing a different era. Bands of marabou masqueraders grinning behind makeshift veils, warriors with sticks marching in formation, an all-woman troop dressed as colonial soldiers, parodying the oppressor as subtle protest. These coded performances kept the language of dissent alive, carrying warnings and wisdom from generation to generation. That evening at the edge of town, a circle of drummers, young, old, every shade of island brown, gathers in counterpoint to the parade. When police wander by, the rhythm shifts instantly from resistance beat to a nursery rhyme, transforming dissent into play. But behind the music, old meanings remain. Escape routes, warnings, the locations of secret rendezvous. Part 3. The Streets Remember. Carnival erupts with daylight, the air dense with talcum, citrus, and the ozone scent of spent fireworks. Costumed bands swarm the streets, devils wielding pitchforks, skeletons rattling bones in well-rehearsed unison, kings and queens with paper crowns ruling republics of rhythm. Above it all, the midnight robber orators deliver booming monologues, their words spinning history as both fable and prophecy. Renee marches at the heart of her band, her mask shimmering with stories. Children trail her, dazzled by the spectacle, but unaware of every hidden meaning stitched into their costumes. Onlookers unaware of the past snap photos, cheering at the painted mockery of colonial uniforms. A few, older or attentive, catch the sly nods, the devil's wink, the stick fighter's coded stomp, the unfinished line of a freedom song that once gave the signal to run. As the parade surges toward the city square, Miriam takes Renee's hand. "When you dance," she whispers, "you're carrying their voices. Every step keeps the promise alive." As dusk falls, the streets overflow with music and memory. Underneath the laughter and pounding drums, if you listen closely, you can still hear the ancient codes. Messages passed in plain sight, never quite deciphered, never entirely lost. Chapter 5. The Revolt That Changed Everything. Part 1. Swords and Spells. The air is charged with heat as dusk seeps through the forest canopy, painting the world in gold and crimson. High in the hills, beyond the sugar fields and colonial fort, the maroon encampment stirs with more than the usual anticipation. Tonight the council gathers, not just to feast or pray, but to prepare for a storm that has been building with each injustice. It is not only men who meet in the firelight, but women and children too, each one knowing that the line between life and legend can blur in a single night. At the center, a ring of elders trace patterns in the dust, half remembered, half improvised, invoking ancestors with cowrie shells and braided cords. Beside them, Obeya, a woman said to wield knowledge of spirits and poisons, murmurs blessings and warnings in a rhythmic blend of languages. Her gaze sweeps the crowd, settling last on Samuel, a young man whose courage is tempered by secret scars. Legend will one day say, "This revolt began with sword and fire," but the first weapons are intangible. Songs coded into drum beats, tokens buried at crossroads to confuse patrols, secret alliances sworn beneath the new moon. As flintlock pistols and cutlasses are counted, Obeya presses a bitter tonic into Samuel's hands. "Tonight," she tells him, "the spirits are on our side, but you must remember who you fight for, those who breathe and those who never made it here." Part 2, Rituals of the Night. Downriver, word spreads in whispers through the slave quarters. "Libon tan kivina," the good time has come. Elderly women hide food in gourd jars, young men tie red scarves about their arms, and children memorize escape paths through cane breaks. Under the pretense of a late harvest, households gather at the edge of the fields. One by one, they slip away as the foreman dozes, slipping into the cover of night. Tonight's rituals fuse the sacred and the profane. Obeah's circle pours rum for the dead, scatters protective herbs, and anoints the blades with oil and ash. Songs, forbidden since the last rebellion, rise among the trees, melodies bending from grief to fury and back again. Priests burn resin to call on LWA, spirit patrons from across the Atlantic, invoked for guidance and luck. Children are taught incantations to ward away fear. Mothers grip their sons and whisper blessings above the swell of the drums. Samuel kneels beside his sister Yvette and presses a wooden bead into her hand, engraved with the symbol for survival, to protect her should they be separated in the chaos to come. Overhead, thunder rumbles, ominous yet oddly comforting. It is said that when freedom is near, even the sky makes its allegiance known. Part 3, The First Blow. After midnight, Samuel leads a small group of rebels toward the overseer's house. They move like wraiths, silent except for the rustle of leaves beneath bare feet. The plan is simple, but the stakes are fatal. Surprise the guards, secure weapons, set signal fires. As he creeps forward, Samuel feels his heart thudding in his palms, a drumbeat accompanying the one echoing from the hills above. A terrier barks, shattering quiet. Samuel lunges, club in hand. The first sound of the revolt is not a gunshot, but flesh striking flesh as he knocks the sentry cold. Behind him, Yvette snatches a musket from the porch, passing it to an older fighter who grins through gritted teeth. The overseer stumbles from his quarters, bellowing as flames lick at the roof. By dawn, the house is razed, and the white flag that was once a sign of surrender now burns as a beacon of resistance. Signal drums transmit the news in every direction. Plantations up and down the valley wake to chaos. Masters fleeing, servants arming themselves. Some hesitate, torn between terror and a hope too fragile to name, but most know there is no going back. Part 4, Retaliation. The initial victories are fierce but fleeting. Militia men from the capital arrive with dogs and carbines. The forest becomes a battleground. Survivors scatter, some to maroon hideouts, others toward distant ports in the hope of finding passage to freedom abroad. Samuel leads a dwindling band through the high passes, each day more dangerous than the last. On the third morning, the militia sets fire to whole villages suspected of aiding the rebels. Yvette, caught along with the mothers and children, is forced into a makeshift cage beneath the blazing sun. When Samuel hears, his world narrows to vengeance and rescue. Grouped with allies and Obeah herself, he launches a desperate assault that scatters their oppressors, freeing his sister and the others. Not all return from the onslaught. The price of resistance is paid in graves dug at the forest's edge. But the story of the rescue spreads quickly, inspiring fresh acts of rebellion from villages once paralyzed by fear. Part 5, The Price of Freedom. When the dust settles, the uprising's totality is uneven. Some plantations are razed, their enslaved populations fled or freed. Other areas fall quickly back under colonial control. The survivors forced to speak of the revolt only in code. Songs hummed during work, symbols sewn into headscarves, names given in secret baptisms. Obeah is arrested, betrayed by a jealous informant, yet her gaze remains undefeated as she stands in makeshift court. Before she is taken away, she spits a final curse at her captors, prophesying storms and famine until her people are free. Even her jailers tremble at the power of her conviction. Samuel and Yvette, battered but unbroken, make their way north, carrying with them stories and symbols of the uprising. In the Maroon Hills, elders receive them not as victims, but as inheritors of an unbroken chain of rebellion. Each year on the revolt's anniversary, families gather in the moonlit woods, lighting candles, singing freedom songs, and whispering the names of the fallen. It is said that each time a drum beats in defiance, Obeya answers in spirit, guiding the living on toward the next horizon of liberty. The wider world will learn little of this revolt, records censored, histories rewritten, blame shifted onto outside agitators. But in every garden tilled by free hands, every lullaby improvised, and every clandestine festival, the true story endures. The Caribbean's fate was always shaped by those who dared to turn song and spirit into sword. Chapter 6, Echoes of Language and Diaspora. Part 1, The Last Tongue. In a shaded yard scented with mango and wood smoke, a grandmother named Estina repeats the same gentle phrase for her granddaughter, Noelle. They are the last in their family to speak Kalinagu, a language older than empire, woven from syllables that echo rivers and birdsong. Each morning, before roosters crow, the lesson begins. Noelle presses her tongue to her teeth, mimicking the odd rhythm, the floating vowels. Estina's stories of Carib queens crossing the Atlantic, gods who made rain, are all told in this nearly vanished tongue. While the outside world rushes by, Noelle learns that words can be secret doors. We hid these sounds in lullabies and work songs, in games only children understood. Kalinagu is a rebellion softer than a drum, persistent as the sea. Villagers call Estina stubborn, but others come quietly to her gate, asking for the right way to say thank you or to bless a baby into the world. She teaches them too, one by one, her voice breaking each time the sun sets, fearing she is the last echo and that the loss will soon be total. Part 2, The Scholar's Gambit. Miles away, in the capital's university, a young linguist named Devon pores over battered notebooks and taped interviews. She knows the number of living native speakers may be counted on one hand. Grant deadlines press, but urgency comes from somewhere deeper, a promise whispered to her by her own grandmother before she passed. If you carry our memory, we do not die. Devon travels from village to mountain, ferry to backroad taxi, headphones always at the ready. She records Estina's lessons, catalogs harvest chants, and uncovers a wealth of unwritten stories preserved in pockets large and small across the islands. Each recording is a spark, a children's rhyme, a fisherman's prayer, a secret curse for unfaithful lovers. Every fragment matters. Facing resistance from some, who recall outsiders only arriving to take, Devon learns to barter for trust, offering groceries, fixing a tin roof, or simply listening, truly listening, before asking her questions. She begins to dream in multiple tongues. Sometimes she wakes from sleep speaking the lost words aloud, heart pounding with the hope that language builds bridges where borders failed. Part 3, Diaspora's Return. The old pier teems with life on Emancipation Day. Markets overflow with cassava cakes, roasted maize, and stewed crab. Under the striped pavilions, narratives swirl, descendants from Trinidad to London to Brooklyn, mingling with relatives who never left. Children speak in the clipped accents of the diaspora, only half comprehending jokes from local uncles and grandmothers. For many, this is a pilgrimage. Some bring trinkets, a faded photo, a crumpled letter, a scrap of the language they have nearly forgotten. Others bring curiosity or guilt, seeking connection across years and oceans. The elders greet them warmly, yet with careful eyes, The world made us leave. Now we must teach you what was left behind. Workshops blossom in the square. Storytelling circles, drumming intensives, lessons in carving and basket weaving. Estina sits surrounded by children and adults alike, her voice slow at first, then gathering power. Noel stands at her side, acting as translator, bridging generations, yet vowing never to let the mother tongue be reduced to mere formality. Devin records every moment, marveling at the electric joy of rediscovery and the bittersweet knowledge that some children will struggle with even the simplest words. But the seeds are planted. For a handful, the longing grows into a promise. Next year, I'll come back knowing more. Part 4. Songlines Unbroken. Night falls and the humid air vibrates with music. Fiddles, bamboo flutes, and battered steel drums weave new verses from ancient roots. Every melody, every rhythm, is a vessel, carrying stories, cataloging triumph and loss, tying the islands together across difference and time. Estina leads a call-and-response lullaby, her audience swaying with the pulse. For those who grew up far from the Caribbean, the song feels like a thread linking them to another self, a version unharmed by distance. For Noel, each chorus is an affirmation. We are the survivors. Our words do not end here. Around the fire, a young boy composes a fresh song in Kalinagu, his rhyme imperfect but defiant. Others pick it up, improvise verses of their own, folding English and Creole into the tune. Laughter abounds. The pleasure of invention is contagious. Even Devin is coaxed into sharing a line, awkward and halting, but greeted by cheers. Somewhere beyond the reach of the firelight, the ocean's hush surges and falls, a steady witness, reminding everyone that what has been nearly lost can still be found, given care, memory, and song. Part 5. Tomorrow's Inheritance. Dawn finds Estina alone, gazing eastward, breathing in salt and hibiscus. Her bones ache, but there's no bitterness in her smile. Noel rests her head in her lap, tired from a night of singing. Later, the family gathers around breakfast, cassava, salted cod, sweet tea. They speak in the old words as long as possible before the outside world reasserts itself. As grandmothers pass the stories once more, Devin records a final farewell. The diaspora children crowd close, hungry for meaning and sound, pleading for translations and songs to take home. What became nearly extinct is reborn, not through scholars or institutions, but through the stubborn, private persistence of families, communities, and exiles who understand that what was almost lost can yet be reclaimed. On the departing ferry, Noel teaches diaspora cousins a counting rhyme in Kalinagu while the island slips out of view. For the first time, Estina feels sure. They aren't the last. They're just the next. Chapter 7. Saltwater Roots and Resilient Harvests. Part 1. The Tides That Bind. As the sun eases above the coast, the wetlands shimmer, a quilt stitched with mangroves, oyster beds, and glints of silver schools darting through tidal creeks. In this narrow stretch where land gifts itself to the sea, the old rhythms persist. Rooted in mud and memory, men and women wade barefoot through the shallows, baskets slung from their hips, laughter carried by the briny wind. Here, the land does not belong to anyone. It is shared, shaped, and battered by hurricanes, replenished by silt, steeled by the hands of generations. Auntie Imani, matriarch of the fishing village, sorts shrimp at the landing by dawn. Her fingers move quick, nimble as she recounts to a cluster of sharp-eyed children the time the sea rose so high the spirits rode in on its back and left us nothing but the will to begin again. Saltwater families are Mosaic, Maroons, indigenous Arawaks, descendants of indentured laborers from India and China. each claiming, in turn, our ancestors found a way to feed us when no storehouse would. The children helped dig for mussels, snare crabs, cast nets, and mend boats. Each lesson is a story, each meal a surging act of gratitude. Part 2, The Hidden Recipes. The kitchen is the heart of resilience. In a hut perched on stilts against spring tides, Imani instructs her granddaughter Zuri in the gathered wisdom of generations. Recipes here carry the codex of survival, a pinch of dried shrimp pounded in a stone mortar, coconut milk pressed by hand, rice wrung soft from patient boiling, all perfumed with thyme and scotch bonnet. These are not just flavors, Imani insists, but messages. If you remember the order, the secrets stay with us. Some days, she cooks bouillon, thick with wild greens foraged from the land, abandoned by colonial overseers. Other days, she makes rundown sauce, combining salt cod, yams, peppers, a dish that arrived in the bellies of ships, transformed by hands bent on making scarcity taste like bounty. Zuri asks why some spices, clove, ginger, even chocolate, carry cautionary tales. Imani answers quietly, "They are our inheritance and our warning. What was forced upon us, we learned to grow. What was denied, we claimed. What tried to erase us, we made sweeter than honey." Their neighbors from the Hindu family next door pound lentils for dal, fold in cumin and coriander, braid marigold garlands for prayer, sharing them with maroon elders each festival. In the cross-pollination of kitchens, borders dissolve and resistance is savored. Part 3, Storms and Survival. Not every season is kind. Hurricanes tear through the shallows, upending stilt houses, salting fields. After each storm, the village emerges with machetes and hauling ropes. No time for sorrow when the tarpon are stranded in the ditches or boats are marooned atop almond trees. Imani leads the effort, directing teens to patch roofs, mothers to cook for the workers, children to collect loose shells for new necklaces. When relief comes, it's usually too little and too late. The villagers rely instead on a memory bank more valuable than any government ledger, the knowledge of which trees bend and don't break, how to catch rainwater, what roots to eat in lean times. Grandfather AJ, stooped yet steady, teaches the young the trick of storing yams and curing fish, chanting, "We survive because we obey the tide, not the clocks of men far away." The storms, both literal and historical, leave behind more stories than scars. Each time the sea erases yesterday's path, the community redraws borders through ritual, a shared meal under tarpaulin, a night of music by lantern light, every handshake a treaty of endurance. Part 4, Seeds of the Future. Years pass, and Zuri grows into her inheritance. She tends the family's small raised beds behind the house, coaxing bitter melon and callaloo from stubborn clay. In every row she plants, she remembers the instructions of her elders: plant three for the land, one for the rain, one for the birds, and one for tomorrow's hunger. The community organizes a yearly harvest festival, a riot of color, music, and spirit. Here, recipes lost to diaspora return, revived by visiting cousins and experimentation. Young people host workshops. One cousin teaches permaculture gardening. Another demonstrates how to turn seaweed into soup, reviving a practice nearly lost with the great-grandparents. At sunset, the entire village gathers for storytelling. Elders recount the legend of the saltwater roots, the first settlers who, after losing everything to the slave trade and exile, made a home no empire could ever fully own. Songs in Creole, Bhojpuri, Yoruba, and Kalinago ripple through the air, each verse a pledge that no ancestor's sacrifice was in vain. Zuri feels the pulse of countless lives beating under her palm as she pounds the mortar, mixing herbs for the next day's feast. In this place, half land, half sea, all memory, survival is not just a reaction. It is an act of creation. Part 5. Inheritance and Renewal. By chapter's end, rain sweeps across the horizon, washing footprints from the beach, but leaving a mosaic of new seedlings pushing up through silt. Imani, now silver-haired and slow of step, sits with Zuri and the new children in the community, recounting, one more time, the story of how a people uprooted by force learn to anchor themselves through nourishment, custom, and collective will. For each salt-rimed dish shared, for every rescued boat, and for every child taught to read the tides, the community brands its legacy not just in oral lore, but in land and practice. The harvest is more than sustenance, the kitchen more than shelter. Both are acts of remembering and an open hand to the next generation. As the stars shimmer above the darkened sea, the villagers know every root planted, every recipe guarded, every story retold is rebellion against erasure. The next generation will inherit not only survival, but the spirit of flourishing. Chapter 8, Healers, Spirits, and Shadowed Remedies. Part 1, Roots Beneath the Floorboards. Before first light, the village healer, Madame Solange, slips from her bed to gather what the forest willingly offers. Her satchel, woven from banana fiber, carries seeds, barks, and leaves, each with a legend, each a vessel for memory. Her small home, perched on the edge of the mangrove, smells of camphor, clove, and pine resin, redolent of generations who believed healing was both an art and an act of resistance. Solange's reputation extends well beyond the village. She is called Mother Herb, or Shadow Woman, revered by those who remember the old ways, and eyed with suspicion by the local magistrate, who mistrusts anything not found in a physician's manual. Yet in each community crisis, from fever outbreaks to broken hearts, her home becomes refuge. With her granddaughter, Leah, she grinds guava leaves and whispers recitations in French patois mixed with snatches of Yoruba. Before each visitor, Solange tucks a small gourd under the floorboards to ward off bad winds and keep ancestral eyes open. This morning, she prepares a poultice for Uncle Jean's cough, caught in the rain too long with grief, and a bath of sweet bush leaves for twins troubled by nightmares. To Leah, learning the recipes is more than apprenticeship. It's learning a language few can speak, grounded in faith, observation, and always a touch of the mystical. Part 2. The Hidden Science of Survival. Villagers gather stories like herbs, cautiously, with reverence, and sometimes in secret. There was a time, not distant, when authorities outlawed Obeya, Vodou, and any practice smacking of Africa or indigenous remnant. Those who persisted risked arrest or exile. Solange's own mother spent months hiding in the forest, teaching her daughter to read omens in birds and to listen for warnings in the wind. Modern schools dismiss the old wisdom as superstition, but the annual influx of city folk, seeking cures for sleeplessness, love lost, barren fields, testifies to the enduring faith in shadow remedies. Solange's kitchen becomes a crossroads. Farmers wanting luck for their crops, fishermen anxious for calming seas, women seeking protection for newborns. Leah learns to blend recipes according to need. Teas laced with bay leaf and lemongrass, syrups of mango bark, incenses that scatter mosquitoes, and, some say, unwelcome spirits. For each cure, Solange insists on respect. Know the root, honor the ancestor, never promise more than the plant can give. Late at night, when all but the frogs are silent, Leah helps her grandmother record the old stories and remedies in notebooks kept hidden from outsiders. Some pages are full of medicinal detail. Others recount the story behind the herb, the slave who feigned sickness to escape the lash, the mother who warded off bad fortune with lime water, the priestess who smuggled root cuttings during the middle passage in the loops of her hair. Part 3. The Possessed and the Protector. The villages in the dawn shadow of the Blue Mountains hold memories of times when sickness swept whole communities, believed to be the work of duppies, spirits of the restless dead, or punishments sent by rivals or colonial masters. At such times, Solange presides over elaborate rituals, calling upon spirit guides for healing and protection. This carnival season, whispers swirl of a restless soul inhabiting a young man named Marcel. He wanders at night, speaking in riddles, his eyes cloudy and voice layered with accents of ancestors never met. His mother, at wit's end, calls for Solange. The ceremony begins at sunset, with women sweeping the yard and men lighting lanterns at the cardinal points. Solange chants, waves smoked leaves, bathes Marcel's forehead with coconut water, and asks the assembled to sing a refrain in a language no longer spoken in daily life, but carried in song. Slowly, Marcel stills. The storm leaves his eyes. Whether cured by faith, rhythm, or plant, the effect is real. Throughout, Leah watches. For her, it is both medical drama and sacred inheritance, a convergence of science, psychology, and spirit work that, for centuries, allowed her people to survive when no one else cared for their bodies or minds. Part 4. The Healer's Dilemma. Solange faces her own worry when a government health inspector arrives, clipboard in hand, sniffing disapproval at every root and bottle. He is courteous, but insistent. These practices have no place in a modern clinic. Solange, undeterred, points to her wall, adorned with photos of children healed after hospitals failed them, and letters of thanks from city doctors themselves. You want modern? I'll show you what modern forgot, she says. She demonstrates how certain herbs lower fever, how others reduce swelling or bring sleep to the anxious. Her knowledge is empirical, her tone respectful, but her message clear. Healing belongs to those who care, not to those who conquer. The inspector, the son of a woman Solange healed in childhood, reluctantly writes a temporary permit, bowing both to tradition and to community will. Part 5. Passing the Baton. One evening, on the edge of the full moon, Solange hands Leah a battered apothecary's pouch and the notebook now swollen with recipes, protection prayers, and family trees. You must choose what to forget and what to remember, she says quietly. Medicine isn't just what you learn. It's what you preserve. Leah, now confident in her hands and heart, leads a healing circle by herself. For a neighbor mourning a loved one lost at sea, for a schoolgirl paralyzed by fear of exams, for a mother new to the island's strange winds. In whispers and laughter, mixing cassava bread with bitter tea, the village celebrates resilience, not just of the body, but of spirit and story. Solange watches from the porch, pride etched in her bones. The healing traditions endure, not despite progress, but alongside it. Living proof that the Caribbean's untold stories flourish wherever faith, knowledge, and communal care interlace. The next time someone falls ill, Leah's hut will be the first door they knock, a quiet mosaic of science, spirit, and memory, ever open against the night. Chapter 9. Tricksters, Rebels, and the Art of Survival. Part 1. The Arrival of Anansi. Dusk cloaks the village in a soft veil, and the elders gather beneath a breadfruit tree, calling the children to sit on woven mats. Tonight's stories are for laughter and learning, A reminder that power isn't always loud, and wisdom comes robed in riddles. At the heart is Anansi, the spider trickster, a figure born in West African legend and reborn on the islands as a champion of wit and resilience. Storyteller Papa Phallix begins, "Long ago, when the world first split, the spider climbed down from the rafters to teach men and women how to use their heads, not only their fists." The children lean in, eyes wide, as Anansi bargains with the sky god, tricks greedy animals, and always manages, by hook or crook, to keep his dignity and a full belly. Adults mingle at the story's edge, knowing these fables are code, when to bend, when to rebel, how to survive against odds that favor the powerful. Anansi's legacy is more than story. It's a toolkit for those forced to navigate forces much larger than themselves. Part 2. The Trickster's Mirror. It isn't only children who learn these lessons. Adults invoke Anansi when dealing with bureaucracy, with rival families, with the lingering traces of colonial power. Aunt Nessa, renowned for talking her way out of fines and into opportunities, is described as having Anansi's tongue. She teaches her niece Janelle how to hide wisdom inside jokes, how to slip warning into a song, how to never tell the whole truth to those who haven't earned it. During Carnival, trickster spirits roam free. Masked as midnight robbers and jab-jab devils, islanders retell old stories in grand monologues and mischievous pranks. The crowd roars approval at bold jests aimed at the powerful, the mayor's bald patch, the magistrate's dance moves, the priest's odd taste in hats. Trickster energy is the sanctioned release for communal critique, a tradition that both frustrates and fortifies the spirit of resistance. One year, Janelle disguises herself as the village postman, distributing letters with fake fortunes and cheeky invitations to secret feasts. By nightfall, even the sternest adults join the revelry, trading insults and compliments with equal flair. Joy becomes its own survival strategy. Part 3. Tales for the Hard Years. Not all trickster tales are carefree. In lean years, when hurricanes flatten fields, when economies falter, or when laws turn against the poor, story becomes shield and balm. Phallix retells the legend of Buki and Malice, where Malice, the underdog, escapes Buki's traps through cleverness, persistence, and risky gambits. A group of young men, tired from a day's labor, debate which trickster tactic works best. "Sometimes you got to play fool to catch wise," one says, echoing his grandmother. Another insists, "Cunning is good, but unity is better." Through laughter, their grief and anger ease. Fable becomes a map for decisions made in the harsh light of day. Grandmothers invent cautionary tales about the sea spirit Mama Glow, who lures greedy fishermen to their doom, teaching that even in survival, respect for community and nature guides the cleverest heart. Part 4. Tricksters in Migration. As many Caribbean sons and daughters venture abroad to work in distant cities or pursue studies in unfamiliar lands, trickster stories follow in their luggage. In London, Toronto, and Brooklyn, Anansi sessions become safe spaces for newcomers trying to outwit discrimination, bureaucracy, and loneliness. Janelle, grown and living in a northern metropolis, recalls how her mother taught her to read a room, find allies, and smile politely while plotting smarter paths. With Caribbean friends, she retells Anansi tales at house parties, layering the fables with new meanings, lessons about navigating subway delays, job interviews, officious landlords. Communal story nights swell with laughter and tears. The trickster's skill in adaptation is echoed by the diaspora's resourcefulness. Even far from home, the art of survival is laced with humor, caution, and cunning. Part 5. Trickster's Promise. Back on the island, another dusk falls. Papa Felix gathers the children once more. "Remember," he intones, his accent rolling, "not every battle is won in a crowd. Sometimes you win by letting the big man think he's clever, while you eat his mango behind his back." The fire crackles, and the youngest child asks, "Is Anansi real?" Felix smiles, tracing a slow spiral in the dust. "He is as real as the stories we keep, and as powerful as the lessons we remember." As moonlight dusts the village roofs, the laughter and wisdom of tricksters soak deep into the bones of a new generation. Survival, the stories affirm, comes not only from strength, but from the sly, resilient joy of outwitting the world, one tale at a time. Chapter 10, Ballads of Resistance and Revolution, approximately 2,500 words, segmented for immersive storytelling and narrative depth. Part 1, The Songs That Moved Mountains. Before the sun crowns the island's peaks, the night pulses with a secret rhythm, a persistent melody played on battered banjo, bamboo flute, and voice. In the mountain village of La Vena, music is more than art. It is survival, history, rebellion. Each note traces the scars and dreams of people denied their stories in official records, but immortalized in ballads sung from porch to cane field. Old Man Republic, the unofficial historian, sits at his stoop cradling a four-string banjo worn smooth by decades. "They used to arrest us just for playing," he says, voice gravelly. "Back then, a song could get you whipped or get you free." Children crowd around as he strums the first chords of Tibef Soti, a folk tune outlawed during the years of colonial suppression. Its lyrics are layered. On the surface, a story of unrequited love. Beneath, a coded map for escape. Village mothers tap time as Old Man Republic recounts how music communicated plans, warnings, and hope in eras where books and newspapers were for the privileged few. Field hands inflected their shouts and syncopations to relay secret words. A single verse, sung at dusk, could summon accomplices or scatter conspirators with the warning, "Danger nears." Part 2, Chantwells and Hidden Leaders. Beyond the mountain valley, coastal towns echo with the sharp voice of the Chantwell, the lead singer in carnival bands and political marches, often a woman or elder whose tongue can outwit any censor. Mira Gonsalves, the village's revered Chantwell, is famed for weaving history and protest into blistering rhyme. Whenever injustice stirs, Mira takes the bandstand, her voice rising above orchestras of steel pan, maracas, and drums. At political rallies, her lyrics blend satire and accusation, relaying facts too dangerous to publish. "If the government taxed the rain, we still go dance in mud," she bellows, the crowd roaring as politicians grimace and force smiles. Children imitate Mira, crafting their own verses to recap schoolyard injustices or poke fun at strict teachers, learning early that language, sung, chanted, or whispered, is a weapon mightier than any fist. Ballads born in hardship travel quickly. A song crafted in one village finds its way downriver, across islands on fishing boats and mail packets, arriving yours in new places stitched with the harmonies of other struggles, other rebels. Part 3, Songs Behind Bars. In the damp, echoing cells of Port Royal Prison, ballads survive the darkest days. Detainees, many held for minor acts of insubordination or undesirable gatherings, fill the night with spirituals stitched from African melodies and local invention. Nicholas, jailed after organizing a fisherman's strike, carves verses onto scraps of paper. He teaches his cellmates Leve Campe, a ballad masked as a work song, but coded to inspire action. Stand and rise. Shoulders straight. The chains you bear are old, but break anew at dawn. The guards, unfamiliar with the old language, dismiss the singing as noise. Among prisoners, each stanza is cherished, memorized, passed down the halls. An older inmate, Pedro, recalls how during a faraway rebellion, freedom fighters hid instructions for uprisings in the refrains of harvest anthems. Sometimes, he tells Nicola, the loudest revolt is sung so softly no empire can hear it. In time, Nicholas's music filters out via visits and smuggled notes, igniting pockets of solidarity well beyond the prison gates. Part 4. Melodies Across Borders. Revolutions breed diaspora as well as songs. Each political tremor sends musicians and songwriters abroad, to Black-owned record shops in Harlem, to Trinidad's Calypso stages, to London's Hackney ballrooms, where homesick communities demand, play us something from home. In exile, composers blend local ballads with blues, funk, and jazz, creating music that roars protest but dances, too, into the heart of global pop culture. Amara, born in Kingston, raised in Toronto, finds herself recording Songs for Return, a mixtape of ancestral protest fused with hip-hop and reggae. Her lyrics mourn what was left behind, but pulse with hope for return, for justice. Through headphones, a new generation learns the anthem. Islands belong to dreamers. Revolutions are born in music. Amara's mother, far away, listens to pirate radio and weeps, sometimes from pride, sometimes for the home she lost to politics and poll taxes. Yet in every verse sung, every diaspora concert, each memory preserved in new sound, the spirits of old rebels dance. Part 5. Reunion of the Voices. 1 year, on the anniversary of emancipation, the village gathers for a midnight jam beneath the banyan tree. Elders and youth share the spotlight, reviving outlawed folk songs and remixing them with Afrobeat, soca, and jazz. Old Man Republic takes the banja, Mira commands the call and response, and diaspora musicians beam live in via satellite link. For the youngest children, it's a concert. For the eldest, it's a benediction, the living proof that the struggle for dignity and autonomy, whether against colonial empires or modern neglect, finds its truest, wildest, and most beautiful form in collective song. As dawn crests, hundreds of voices join, freedom, freedom, not just a word, but a rhythm we play. For one luminous morning, history's pain and hope blend. The next chorus belongs to those who will never be named, only remembered every time the beat summons ancestors and descendants alike onto a single pulsating dance floor. Chapter 11, Painters, Carvers, and the Wall That Speaks. Part 1, Fragments on the Old Wall. At sunrise, the city's oldest quarter stirs awake, the yellow light painting cracked stucco and mosaic tiles with the promise of another day. On the edge of the marketplace, a battered wall, paint peeling, covered in overlapping murals, becomes an unofficial archive. Here, generations of artists, carvers, and activists have documented joy and grief when neither the government nor the press would listen. 12-year-old Cesar slips out of his house at dawn, sketch pad tucked under arm, eager to copy the latest design. A phoenix rising from sugarcane, the feathers inscribed with the names of vanished poets. His grandmother, Celeste, pauses to admire a mosaic in the corner, bits of colored glass shaped like sugar apples and okra, set among etched phrases in Creole. Every stone tells a story, she gently reminds. Workers pass, offering nods. For Cesar and Celeste, the wall is classroom, confessional, memorial, rebuilt every time a hurricane or government directive tries to erase it. Part 2, The Masters and the Apprentices. The legend of Madu Bey, the blind carver, still echoes in studios and workshops across the city. As a young man, Maru sculpted saints for colonial cathedrals, but under the cover of night turned driftwood into fierce, laughing masks, each a sly commentary on power and survival. He taught dozens of apprentices, passing down the discipline of patience, how to coax stories from fallen limbs, how to see with hands what eyes could not reveal. His star disciple, Afia, leads the new guard. She anchors a cooperative where women, once forbidden entry into serious arts, shape clay into heroes and heroines with broad hips and upraised fists. Some of their work graces galleries in Paris and New York. Most remains at home, lining village wells and schoolyards, reminders that culture is not for sale. Caesar, hungry for praise, volunteers at Afia's studio. She encourages his sketches. Don't draw me what you see. Draw me what you dream happened here. Inspired, he paints a flock of birds lifting a shackle into the sky. The image finds its way onto posters for the next festival, shared across social networks and kitchen fridges alike. Part 3. The Rebellion of the Brush. A period of unrest brings soldiers to the square, charged with scrubbing out seditious graffiti. Overnight, messages of hope and defiance appear faster than the authorities can whitewash them. Crick, crack, blazes across the wall in bold red, invoking the call and response of griot storytellers and daring all who pass to remember. Afia orchestrates a campaign. Children and elders gather by moonlight to repaint beloved icons. Freedom drums, trickster spiders, ships arriving and departing, headscarved heroines cradling books, all woven into a single panoramic story. Each symbol is layered. To the uninitiated, mere decoration. To the people, a catalog of victories and losses, of ancestors too unruly for textbooks. One night, Celeste leads Cesar to the wall after curfew, unveiling a fresh carving beneath the vines, a line of faceless figures holding hands across islands and continents. We are many, but our story is one, she whispers, her breath warm against his cheek. Part 4. Murals in Exile. As waves of migration scatter artists abroad, island aesthetics awaken in unexpected places. Subway pillars in Brooklyn covered by lush turquoise mermaids, murals blooming on the brick walls of Brixton, carved chairs and painted gourds on display in underground galleries from Montreal to Marseille. Afia, traveling to a diaspora art festival, marvels at 100 feet of mural depicting carnival scenes she's never attended but instantly recognizes. Each brushstroke a bridge between loss and belonging. She befriends a sculptor exiled after protesting police violence, who now twists reclaimed metals into defiant dancing figures. Together, their works give solace to expats missing the scent of guava or the syncopated chorus of crickets. Caesar emails digital sketches to cousin Luke in Miami, who hosts pop-up shows for Caribbean students. Their art, once dismissed as folk, is embraced as modern resistance, sparking dialogues about freedom, memory, and the right to narrate one's own story. Part 5. The Wall Reborn. Back home, the municipal wall is battered by the latest hurricane, its surface pitted and raw. The morning after, Cesar and Celeste inspect the wreckage. For the first time, Cesar is allowed to lead the restoration. He recruits classmates and neighbors, with Afia's blessing, to repaint what was lost, but also to invent what comes next. Children fingerprint the base with suns and turtles. Young artists stencil tributes to healthcare workers, farmers, and healers. The old is honored, the new is ushered in. The wall stretches and breathes, a living witness attuned to every sorrow, delight, triumph, and pain. At dusk, the community gathers for an unveiling, music and food filling the square. Celeste, eyes shining, reads aloud from a plaque, To all the painters, carvers, dreamers, rebels, past, present, and future, this wall is our mirror and our memory. May no storm or dictator ever silence its truth. The night closes with song and laughter. Caesar, paint still smeared on his hands, knows their work won't last forever. But for now, and for generations, every inch is an act of persistence, a declaration that Caribbean stories belong not only to the powerful, but also to every hand daring to leave a mark. Chapter 12, Lost at Sea, Voyages, Shipwrecks, and the Tides of Fate. Part 1, The Sailor's Legend. Dawn kindles the horizon just as Captain Edouard Rouge whistles his crew awake aboard the battered sloop, La Liberté. The harbor, a mosaic of masts and bobbing canoes, smells of brine and possibility. For centuries, the sea has shaped every story on these islands, carrying explorers, pirates, traders, and revolutionaries, sometimes all within one bloodline. Edward is the last in a line of sailors famous for outsmarting governors and hurricanes alike. In his family, tales of miraculous crossings, curse-haunted islands, and ships filled with gold are recited with the same reverence as prayers. Yet, within these seafaring sagas, the shadow of disaster lingers. Our stories swim with the drowned, his grandmother always said, braiding salt into his hair for luck. A restless energy ripples through the crew as word arrives of an old ship, Le Genereux, long thought lost to the deeps, sighted drifting near a forbidden shoal. Edward gathers a motley band, fisherfolk, smugglers, historians, and charts a course into waters where compasses lie and every breaker whispers a warning. Part 2, Shipwrecks and Survivors. The expedition battles capricious winds, sometimes becalmed under a sun that feels intent on bleaching memory away, sometimes tested by rain squalls so fierce only stories can outlast them. On the third night, lightning silhouettes a splintered hull, half consumed by coral, the bones of Le Genereux. Aboard, remnants speak of panic and ingenuity, ropes woven from sari cloth, talismans carved in haste, a logbook with entries in French, Yoruba, and a scattering of Hindi. Edouard and his historian companion, Dr. Patrice Jewell, decipher, the ship once carried runaways and rebels, hounded from three continents, bound for the one place empire could never reach, freedom sought on open water. Stories surface from the depths, Marin fugitives fleeing recapture, indentured laborers seeking their vanished kin, sailors who claimed they saw the island sink beneath the waves at dawn. Traces of ritual persist, seashell necklaces hung for guiding spirits home, libations poured through a crack in the deck for those lost during the crossing. Each finding binds the living to the vanished. Patrice insists every shipwreck is a message in a bottle, history refusing to surrender to salt or silence. Part 3, Ballads of the Sea. In port taverns, where lamplight flickers over rum and dominoes, old-timers sing laments for lost lovers and vanished fleets. Songs like Madame Moore's and The Golden Slaver, or the Creole shanty, Zandalee Gone Down Below, tell of storms, betrayals, impossible escapes, and the ghosts that sometimes steer a drifting vessel straight home. One night, Edward's cousin, Amélie, a violinist and sailor herself, performs a song her father composed after surviving a wreck. The tune weaves between joy and sorrow, lilting with belief that, even when drowned, our ancestors steer us, pointing always toward home. The crew listens as if hearing a secret not meant for daylight, comforted and unnerved in equal measure. Some tales warn of Duan, the souls of children lost at sea, said to play tricks or guide ships astray. Others revere Mamadlo, the goddess of the deep, who sometimes saves mariners, sometimes exacts tribute for her protection. Islanders chant her praises before every voyage, tucking silver coins or hibiscus petals into their pockets as tokens. Part 4. Trading, Smuggling, and Struggle. The sea is more than myth. It is constant negotiation. Edward's ancestors once traded sugar and indigo, but also news of rebellion, codes for maroon runaways, and forbidden books passed between ports. In lean years, fishermen turned to smuggling. Salted fish, barrels of spirits, letters sewn into hems, even fugitives stowed in secret compartments. At the heart of every journey is risk. Storms that level crops, sudden embargoes, naval blockades, betrayal by a captain grown profit-hungry. Patrice documents these harrowing crossings. Safe houses hidden in coves, alliances with indigenous navigators, the secret marks on coconut trees indicating which harbors were safe, which guarded by Empire's dogs. One tale persists, a smuggler named Selim, of East Indian descent, who sailed against the British blockades to ransom his family from forced contract. Guiding by stars and a memory for every shoal, Selim outwitted the colonial navy, then disappeared, some say to another island, some to a life among the spirits of the deep. Part 5. Reunion and Memory. Storms break the return journey, scattering Edward's crew for a desperate night on open water. In the black void, each sailor clings to a fragment, a rag doll, a prayer, a song whispered against the wind. When the wind calms, dawn reveals Legenera fully claimed by the sea, but the rescuers, battered yet alive, gather at the safe harbor's mouth. In the weeks that follow, the village holds a festival, not just for survival, but to welcome home the stories salvaged from the waves. Fisher folk, maroon descendants, newcomers all share the feast. Amelie plays her storm song as elders pour rum into the surf for absent friends. Dr. Patrice presents her findings, placing a salvaged talisman in the square beneath a banyan tree. May those lost ships keep guiding us, toward each other, toward truth. Cousins and strangers swap sea ballads well past midnight. For a moment, the weight of the centuries, chained crossings, exile, the hope of going home, lifts, replaced by the laughter and pulse of those who endured. As the stars wheel overhead, Edward's youngest nephew, sleepy and salt-streaked, asks, "But uncle, will we also be lost?" Edward smiles, ruffles his hair, and answers, "No story is lost while a voice remains to tell it. That is the tide we ride, always, homeward." Chapter 13. Queens of Defiance. Women Who Shape the Islands. Part 1. Mothers of Resistance. Before sunrise, the estate kitchen buzzes with the secret energy of women carrying more than burdens. They carry strategy, memory, and the promise of change. Nana Adeline, her back stooped but eyes sharp as cut grass, presides over the kitchen's orchestrated chaos with iron will and gentle humor. Here, recipes are passed with coded phrases, hand pies folded with more than filling. Inside, notes and escape maps are tucked for trusted hands. History's official accounts rarely mention the women who hid runaways between baskets of yams or brewed teas laced with information for rebels. Nana Adeline, whose youngest sister vanished in the last Maroon Rebellion, quietly arranges evening gatherings, teaching daughters and neighbors songs with lines that signal the next meeting will be at the river, come dusk. Every melody is a thread in a net of resistance. Part 2. The Defiant Leaders. Along the northern shore, the legend of Queen Nanny, warrior, healer, tactician, thrives in the wild ginger and maroon banners woven into household shrines. On the anniversary of Nanny's ambush at the cliff, known only to maroon kin, women gather beneath torchlight. Here, Mavis, a teacher and griot, spins tales painted with the courage of those who turned cookpots into cauldrons and laundry into signals for freedom. Young ones, never believe freedom came only with the gun. It came with cassava, with secret births, with a mother's warning, Mavis declares. Young girls whisper her words, eyes wide at stories of Nanny trapping armies with illusion, reciting charms and leading warriors with codes sewn into skirts and shawls. These are the mothers of every new generation's courage. Part 3. Matriarchs of Market and Movement. In the capital, markets bloom with color and song. Women run stalls not just with might, but with knowledge, a trading floor of rumor, news, and collective negotiation. Market queens like Miss Nola wield influence beyond bureaucracy's reach. She settles disputes, organizes market holidays in protest of unfair taxes, and leads day-long strikes when traders are threatened by officials or developers. Miss Nola's power is born from generations of women who turned commerce into community. Fishmongers funding scholarships for daughters barred from attending colonial schools, spice traders hiding written pamphlets among bins of nutmeg, seamstresses sewing independence flags into church robes. At home, she is mentor, preparing her niece Tasha to inherit both traditions, the arc of courage and the art of strategic silence. Part 4. The Keepers of Healing. Deep inland, midwives, herbalists, and priestesses sustain communities against plagues, storms, and government neglect. Sister Altagracia, an elder who has delivered entire families and survived 4 epidemics, is renowned for her healing hands and fiercely protective spirit. She trains young apprentices, insisting, "Each child is born free. Let no one forget who first holds the future." When cholera threatens, Altagracia leads the effort to organize quarantines, distribute coconut water, and provide hope with rituals that merge remembered African practices and Catholic prayers. Her knowledge is respected not only for its power, but for the mercy and dignity she bestows in each encounter. In times of sorrow, after a hurricane, a failed crop, or a painful birth gone wrong, her kitchen is the sanctuary. Women flock here, in need of counsel, stories, or comfort, knowing that resilience is as much about tending hearts as healing wounds. Part 5. Heroines in Shadow and Light. Stories of resistance are passed not only through public acts, but through acts of daily survival. During the years of mass migration, women like Miss Claudette, a seamstress, support entire families across oceans. Her letters carry, between lines of weather and remittance, advice on schooling, warnings about landlords, and reminders of festival dates. In every suitcase, she tucks a scrap of carnival costume or a jar of homemade pepper sauce, tokens of belonging and memory. The younger generation, Cleo, Simone, Aisha, lead new waves of protest, organizing online campaigns, defending coastal lands against development, performing protest poetry at city squares. Their activism stands upon platforms built by mothers, aunts, and grandmothers, each voice a chord in the greater anthem. On Emancipation Day, a living chain forms along the Capitol's main road. Girls and women, lawyers and cooks, teachers and janitors side by side. They carry quilts embroidered with the names of the forgotten. Heroines who lived, died, and shaped the islands in ways no colonizer's record can capture. That night, as bonfires burn and the sea sings its salt hymn, Nana Adeline leads a closing prayer. "We are the root and the branch. Let the world forget us if it must. We remain, stronger for every shadow the sun cannot erase." Chapter 14. Festivals of Light. Carnival, Ritual, and Collective Memory. Part 1. The Dawn of Carnival. In the hush before sunlight gilds the city's hills, Port Royal is already alive with anticipation. Drum beats tumble across streets empty of cars, but full of costumed children and costumers prepping last flourishes. Carnival here is more than a spectacle. It's a ritual space where every boundary, race, class, history, is for a time joyously undone. Leonie, a young seamstress, hand stitches the final row of beads on her daughter Naya's first Moss costume. Above them, from window balconies, elders tie pennants of every island color, a kaleidoscope of belonging. For weeks, families have prepared, sewing, drumming, rehearsing dances, perfecting ancient recipes carried over oceans and through the fires of memory. Carnival is both inheritance and invention. It threads French, African, Indian, and Arawak rites into a single bustling procession. Each band tells a different story, devils and queens, lost ancestors and new hopes, remixed year after year to honor what persists and subvert what oppresses. Part 2. Rituals of Remembrance. As sunlight floods the main square, the carnival's elder stateswoman, Mama Yvain, leads her troop in the opening procession. She swings a calabash rattle, her steps measured and fierce. Every movement is charged with memory. She carries on centuries of ancestors who danced to survive, to mourn, to resist. Mama Yvain's eyes, clouded by age, sharpened by wisdom, lock with Leonie's as she passes. "Dance the story every step," she whispers for all to hear. The midnight robbers swagger by, speeches stitched with humor and indictment. They lampoon authority, recite histories ignored in schools, and rework legends into living commentary. Each costume bursts with symbolism, shackles breaking, crops flowering, blue rivers twisting through red flames. Teenagers in stick-fighting garb circle in ritual combat, their performance both exuberant and encoded, a memory of maroon uprisings painted in bold strokes. Dancers form mosaics in the streets. Between them float incense and the smell of roasting corn. The old market is transformed into a shrine, stalls decorated with altar cloths and photos of ancestors, tables laden with offerings, saltfish fritters, cassava bread, cakes sweetened by thyme. Part 3. Days of Pageantry, Nights of Fire. Carnival stretches for 3 days and nights, each wave of festivity building on the last. The blue devils emerge before dawn, faces smeared with indigo and glitter, chasing spectators with playful menace. The crowd responds with mock fear and laughter, clinking coins into tin cups as ancient bargains are renewed. Evenings belong to the torchlight parades, bands winding through alleys, accompanied by steel pan orchestras, singers, and orators. The air grows electric. Elders say the flames scare off duppies, the restless spirits of carnival past. Children, high atop parents' shoulders, wave sparklers and recite old poems. When the drums talk, the dead remember. Leonie, exhausted but exultant, twirls Naya in a dance she learned from her own grandmother. For a moment, the city's history of enslavement, rebellion, migration melts into a single swirl of color, sound, and belonging. Part 4. Mask and Meaning. In quieter corners, carnival is also a time for smaller rituals, altars for absent loved ones, secret exchanges of love letters, the burning of written wishes. Aunt Mira decorates her stoop with marigolds and 3 candles, as her mother did, humming the old Chante Mas in a language she barely recalls but feels in her bones. Mask makers trade whispers about the old ways, how some colors are for fertility, certain feathers for prosperity, specific gestures to welcome luck. Across town, the Hindu community winds through the evening with drums for Pagwa, tossing colored powder and blessing the new year. For first-generation returnees, children of the diaspora coming home, Carnival is discovery and renewal. They move awkwardly at first, but community elders guide them, teaching steps, correcting accents, folding them into the dance. "This costume is yours too," an uncle says, pinning coral beads to his niece's sash. Part 5. The Afterglow of Memory. On the festival's final night, the city crowd surges to the waterfront as bonfires blaze along the sand. The mayor and market queens join hands. Leonie nestles Naya close, casting a wish into the flames for safe passage through another year. From the crowd, songs rise, asterisks of old and new, in French Creole and English, Yoruba, and Bhojpuri echoes. Mama Yvaine closes the formalities with a blessing, voice quivering but strong. "We remember so much, what was taken and what we made our own. This is our act of faith. We are Carnival, and Carnival is us." As dawn creeps in, the streets quiet, confetti swirling in the breeze, the scent of incense lingering. Children fall asleep in painted faces. Carnival may end, but the memory of belonging, of resistance, of joy, anchors within, ready to bloom next year. Chapter 15. Story Keepers, The Craft of Remembering. Part 1. The Gathering. Twilight coaxes a hush from the hills as the villagers assemble at the base of a giant saman tree, its roots tangled in myth, its branches a living archive. This is Story Night, held each full moon since anyone can recall. Mats are arranged in wide circles, lanterns flicker, and the scent of roasted cashews laces the air. In the center sits old Griot Sacha, voice as textured as aged rum, keeper of stories that predate every calendar. Tonight, young Omar volunteers as the runner, tasked with fetching stories passed down by elders too frail to come. Children squirm as Sacha begins the invocation, a chant in three languages, Arawak, French Creole, and English, an oral passport uniting ages and identities. Each speaker's turn is earned by riddle, song, or whispered memory. Some nights, the crowd hears tales of duppies and jumbies, but tonight is for chronicles, how the people survived storms, hid from raiders, and mapped the stars before compasses. Part 2. The Remakers. Beside the fire, Aunt Thea, once the island's librarian, recalls the burning of the old city library decades before. With nearly every record destroyed, the elders became walking manuscripts, teaching children the art of line memory. Simple stories recited, then embroidered with details each time, ensuring that history grew, adapted, and thrived. "Without written records," she tells the circle, "we wrote ourselves onto each other's hearts." She explains the code, births marked by song, deaths by candlelit refrains, betrayals scarred into proverbs used in everyday scoldings and lullabies. Islanders remember not just from habit, but because forgetting, for centuries, was dangerous, sometimes fatal. A teen named Ken plays the bamboo flute, accompanying a group of dancers reenacting the Rain Feast, an epic recalling how villagers once tricked a greedy governor out of his water rations, saving the crops during a drought. The laughter binds the generations. Every routine is an improvised archive, each joke a defiant footnote. Part 3. The Losses and the Silences. Not all memories come easily. Sasha's cousin, Maud, revisits the silences that linger. Relatives lost to forced migration, lovers vanished in uprisings or hurricanes, entire communities erased by plant disease or progress. In her husky whisper, she recounts the last walk, where women led children through the hills at midnight to escape conscription. The audience falls quiet as Maud describes how, for generations, silence was a shield. Dangers weren't spoken, but danced, sung, or symbolized. Secrets buried in recipe ingredients or beadwork patterns. Even now, some stories are told only to kin, never allowed under open sky. When a small boy asks why she doesn't write everything down, Maud answers, because memory is more than words. It's the look on your face when you remember who you are. Part 4. New Storytellers. New Ways. Change comes as inevitable as the sea breeze. Now, with digital recorders and smartphones, the youngest generation captures voices and songs often lost to time. Layla, home from university in Kingston, works on an oral history project, interviewing fishers, tracing family trees, and cataloging dialects. Some elders resist the camera, fearing theft of spirit. Others embrace the attention, proud to be preserved like guava jelly. Layla's work stitches the past into the present, uploading interviews for islanders abroad to rediscover recipes, riddles, and music. Her cousin sets the tales to beats, creating viral story mixtapes shared in Miami, Montreal, and beyond. What began as survival now becomes legacy. Yet, the physical circle remains sacred. Even with screens in every home, the full moon gatherings attract emigrants who return hungry for the taste of home. Grandmother Rose, now in her 90s, tells her favorite tale of the trickster who outwitted death, then shares her own memories of hurricanes survived, courtships won and lost, and naming storms after the ancestors. Part 5. The Continuance. After hours, as the crowd fades and only the fire's embers crackle, Sasha recites the blessing that closes every story night. We remember, so we remain. The youngest children curl into elders' laps. Teens slip away to the beach, retelling the best jokes and rumors in low voices. Omar, still the runner, helps gather the mats, then lingers, soaking in the warmth, knowing soon it will be his turn to keep the oldest tales alive. Sasha places a hand on his shoulder. Stories are roots, boy. Even when you move, remember to take the seeds with you. High above, the saman tree rustles in salt breeze. The stories, old and new, hang in the air. Lessons, warnings, laughter, hope, all waiting for their next telling. On this island, memory is a living lamp, and the keepers never sleep. Chapter 16. Land and Legacy, Battles for Belonging. Part 1. The Land Beneath Our Feet. Dawn breaks over the hills, painting the fields with streaks of rose and ochre. On the oldest farmstead, Marie Lois surveys her family's plot, a quilt of cassava, pigeon peas, and bananas, bordered by a crumbling stone wall. Each generation has tended this land since emancipation, their footprints pressed deep in the red earth. But peace is fragile. Marie Lois watches as strangers in crisp suits, surveyors and developers, pace the road with measuring wheel and bored expression. Rumors swirl of new resorts, foreign investors, and government surveys that threaten to redraw boundaries, leaving smallholders like herself insecure. Her heart aches at the thought. If we lose the land, we lose the ancestors who breathe through every root and furrow. The community gathers in the schoolhouse after market. Elders, farmers, fishers, and a handful of returning students. They pore over deeds faded to near invisibility, sketching lines from memory when paperwork falls short. For them, the land is not just property, but inheritance and identity. Mother, altar, and shield. Part 2. The Long Shadow of Ownership. The struggle for land echoes back through generations. Oral histories, often more reliable here than written records, tell of the earliest grants to freed people. Thin strips of hillside, often stony and hard to farm, yet fiercely prized. Some families pooled resources to buy small plots. Others squatted on what no planter wanted, building homes from driftwood and willpower. Marie Loise's great-grandfather, Cletus, was rumored to have walked 40 miles to the capital to sign papers he could not read, then buried the only copy beneath the calabash tree, convinced the real proof of ownership was his sweat in the soil. Over decades, boundaries shifted as streams changed course and storms obliterated landmarks. Sometimes, communities drew new maps with walking sticks and stories. Yet, tension persists between tradition and law, memory and bureaucracy. Outsiders see unclaimed land. Locals see a living archive of families, dreams, and unfinished promises. Part 3. The New Colonizers. Changes come not as marching armies, but in the click of cameras and the signing of contracts. A luxury eco-resort company arrives, touting development and opportunity. Their pamphlets promise jobs, schools, and new clinics in town, but the fine print reserves the beach and much of the hillside for private use. Some townsfolk are tempted, especially the young, hungry for steady wages and adventure. Others, like Marie Loise and her cousin Alain, resist. They call this progress, but I hear exile in every promise. Friction flares at town meetings. Old alliances face the strain of fast money and the threat of displacement. Environmental groups and diaspora lawyers lend support, helping residents contest surveys and file legal challenges. The struggle is both public, protests, banners, appeals to the media, and quietly personal, with whispered plans of blockades and songs revived from older land battles. Part 4. Rituals of Protection and Protest. At the height of crisis, the community turns once more to ceremony, a night-long vigil beside the big almond tree, drumming, reciting ancestors' names, and weaving talismans from vetiver and palm. The elders lead children encircling the threatened fields, invoking blessings for protection and justice. Songs blend from the sacred to the militant. Harvest chants merge into freedom anthems. Old Miss June, who as a girl hid sugarcane cuttings in her skirts to avoid British patrols, now leads the chorus, her voice cracking but fierce. Who owns the land, owns the future. The town's youth organize a sit-in on the access road, live-streaming their stance to cousins abroad, quickly attracting support from islands near and far. Their homemade signs, land is memory, roots before resorts, go viral, seeding conversations where none had ever taken place. Part 5. Claiming Tomorrow. Legal battles crawl through months of delay, but a miracle comes not from judges, but from unity. An agreement, hard bargained, protects community farmland and ensures access to ancestral beaches. Some compromise, opening a small eco-guest house run by locals with profits earmarked for school and health clinic. Marie Loise, once fearful, becomes a leader, teaching workshops on soil restoration and ancestral gardening. She spearheads a project to map every family plot, blending GPS with oral testimony, ensuring that the next threat never finds the people unprepared. At the first harvest after victory, the entire community comes together for a celebration. Gourds filled with coconut water, celebrated with music and tales of previous generations, the freedom to plant, to walk the land, and to decide one's destiny is toasted by all, young and old, at home and in the diaspora. As evening quiets the field, Marie Loise days down beneath the calabash tree, tracing the soil's ridges with grateful fingers. We are not only keepers of the past, she whispers to her grandchildren, but builders of what comes next. Remember, to love land is to love your story and your people, fiercely and forever. Chapter 17. Guardians of Green, Fighting for Future Forests. Part 1. Murmurs in the Canopy. The first violet light of day seeps through the rainforest canopy, dappling the undergrowth with shifting patterns. On these forested slopes, far above the spas and beach resorts, a new generation learns that survival is not inherited. It is protected, defended, and sometimes won back, leaf by stubborn leaf. Paolo, a young biologist, leads a dawn hike with primary schoolers, his pockets brimming with seed pods, ID tags, and battered field notebooks. "Every leaf you step on," he says quietly, "has a story. Some come from before the first ships. Some are older than memory." Alongside him, Auntie Bev, a veteran community organizer, points out vines once used to tie maroon cabins or brew fever remedies. Tensions simmer. Across the range, loggers and bulldozers have crept closer, pushed by global demand for rare hardwoods and government deals for new roads. Rumors float of bribes, of land sold without consent, of sacred groves marked for agro-development. But here, among the green breath of the island, resistance begins with naming. Children learn the old tree names, the songs for calling rain, the warnings of fires and drought. Part 2. The Roots of Rebellion. Environmental activism on the island is not new. Auntie Bev recounts the great protest of the 1970s when villagers formed a green blockade, locking arms, chaining themselves to mango and Samoan trees, and holding night-long vigil against chainsaws and hired thugs. Songs born that season remain anthems, chanted beneath banners and hummed in kitchens during tense town meetings. The elders teach that guardianship is more than protection. It's reciprocity. The forest gifts food, water, medicine, and shade, and asks in return only care and remembrance. Paolo's research, built on his grandmother's plant stories, maps the rare orchids and nesting pairs that live where the ancestors hid in times of war. Each species is a record of both loss and survival. Folklore frames the forest as alive with spirits. Duppies in old trees, trickster jumbies in the thickets, green woman seen before great change. Every activist meeting opens with respect paid to the earth, sometimes with a libation, sometimes a whispered blessing. "Protecting the forest is protecting our dead and our children," Paolo explains, all at once. Part 3. The Threat Descends. Conflict comes with blaring horns and orange-vested crews setting survey stakes. A newly approved road will slice through a hillside the villagers call Ancestor Ridge. The environmental review is rushed. Promises of minimal impact ring hollow. Auntie Bev and Paolo mobilize. They form an alliance with youth activists, market women, birders, local musicians, and lawyers from the diaspora. Strategies blend the old and new. Petitions, street theater, viral hashtags, interviews on radio and social media. Villagers revive the blockade tradition, staging a standing forest festival. Music, art, and protest entwine among the vines as journalists and influencers arrive. At night, drums reverberate, and by day, schoolchildren march with painted signs. "Our forest, our future, and no roots, no rest." Some divisions flare. Those who desire jobs from the developers, or who fear retaliation, argue for compromise. Paolo listens but stands firm, reminding all that short-term profit for a few means drought, mudslides, and lost harvests for all. Part 4. Rituals of Resilience. Battle lines harden as bulldozers idle at the forest's edge. Legal wrangling intensifies. Elders present oral histories as evidence of sacred land. Botanists identify unique species found nowhere else. Traditional healers testify that the destruction threatens not only bodies, but but spirits. Ancestors, whose resting places are mapped in old stories, not on land deeds. On the eve of confrontation, the community hosts a night-long vigil beneath the Great Samaran Tree. They light candles, pour libations of coconut water, and sing Green Woman's Lullaby in a dozen languages. Artists paint murals on the asphalt, children decorate trees with ancestor ribbons, and local chefs prepare food for all, nourishing the spirit of unity and hope. Stories emerge of past victories, of land reclaimed after hurricanes and debts repaid with seasons worth of fruit. Songs mingle with plans, nonviolent resistance, strategic litigation, and global outreach. Paulo reads a letter of support from islanders in Canada, Britain, and New York. The roots you defend feed us wherever we go. Part 5, Victory and the Work Ahead. When dawn breaks, the bulldozers remain at the roadside. News has spread. The government, under mounting pressure, has called a temporary halt to the project pending full consultation. Cheers erupt, tears flow, and Auntie Bev lifts a trembling palm to the sky. The celebration is cautious but profound. In the weeks that follow, the alliance persists. Community mapping continues, elders' tales are cataloged alongside satellite imagery, and kids plant hundreds of seedlings in the newly protected clearing. Paulo and Auntie Bev collaborate with university researchers to establish a community forest trust, ensuring local stewardship enshrined in law. Not all threats vanish. The struggle for land and forest is unending, and the young are reminded that vigilance is legacy's true price. Yet, as the first yellow pui bloom bursts above the canopy, hope is tangible. For every story told and every root defended, the island knits itself, branch by branch, closer to a future where ancestors and children alike may find shelter. On the final evening, the village gathers beneath the same giant tree. Elders and children clasp hands in a living ring of resistance and renewal. "This is the way," Auntie Bev declares, voice fierce and soft at once. "We are guardians of more than trees. We are guardians of every tomorrow." Chapter 18. Justice in the Balance. Courts, Colonial Hauntings, and the Fight for Rights. Part 1. The Courthouse at the Crossroads. A haze of red dust hangs over the village square as families file toward the old courthouse. Its columns weathered, flag barely catching the dawn breeze. Built in colonial times, the building stands at a literal crossroads where merchants once flogged debts from planters and soldiers sent rioters into exile. Now, its shadow looms over the newest battle for belonging, a court case to determine who will own the land and shape the future. Inside, Judge Simone Baptiste, the first local woman to preside over the district, settles her robe with practiced gravitas. Her presence unsettles some. Elders recall the days when only pale faces meted out justice, but inspires hope in children who recite her name with awe. Today's docket is full: a land rights challenge against a resort company, a pollution suit against a mining firm, and a case involving a group of musicians denied a permit on the basis of noise and morality. Part 2. Echoes of Empire. The building rings with ghosts, portraits of bygone governors, cracked marble floors worn by generations seeking mercy or redress. Attorney Marcus Paul, a descendant of indentured servants, stands to present evidence for the community. In his hands, the legal brief is also a love letter to the land, citing oral histories, rare maps, and the testimony of elders. The defense, armed with crisp documents and slick urban lawyers, leans on precedent set in courts thousands of miles away. The law, they argue, is written plainly. But Marcus counters, the law must also listen. Where was the plain language for ancestors who couldn't write, whose boundaries were rivers, not deeds. Judge Baptiste carefully folds her hands, asking both sides to listen to testimony from Grandmother Therese, who walks with a cane carved by her maroon grandfather. Therese's voice shakes as she tells of borders enforced not with lines, but with drums and banquets, and how the hillside marked for development is the burial ground of generations. Part 3. Cases of Resistance. After lunch, the next case calls courtroom and crowd to rapt attention. Children from the coastal town, represented by their science teacher, seek an injunction against a mining project leaking chemicals into their bay. Environmental tests, children's drawings of dying fish, and local songs of warning are entered as evidence. For many, this is the first time their language, Creole, Patois, song, becomes part of the official record. The judge invites all to speak, including the mining company's director. Stories pile up like driftwood, fishermen with empty nets, workers told not to ask about rashes, women who memorize the old ways of filtering water but wish for newer, just solutions. When the verdict comes, an order for an independent review and a temporary halt, tears and cheers ripple through the gathered families. Music swells just outside. The band denied a permit for public disturbance takes the opportunity to play, turning protest into festival. Their song praises justice as a river that sometimes overflows its banks to nourish the parched and humble. Part 4. Rewriting the Records. The struggles within the courthouse mirror arguments happening across the region. How to reckon with laws drafted for empires, not for the living land or communities they once sought to suppress. Local journalists document the proceedings. Teachers bring students to observe. And social media lights up with hashtags demanding transparency and honor for voice as much as evidence. In her chambers, Judge Baptiste reviews a stash of letters from diaspora supporters, lawyers who fled dictatorships, students in Paris and Toronto writing to share strategies and legal research. Every message is a thread in the tapestry of a new judiciary, slowly transforming a colonial relic into a house of dignity. At home, Marcus studies court recordings, mapping how unwritten traditions might one day become new precedents, how land blessed by ancestors, trees planted for the free, and rivers saved by community might inform law's next horizon. Part 5, The Verdict and What Comes After. When, after weeks of hearings, Judge Baptiste delivers the main ruling on the land case, the mood in the square is taut. She rules that the hillside and its burial grounds are of extraordinary community value and places a conservation order on the land. The resort is ordered to renegotiate, this time with the community at the table and obligations to invest in local schools, not just security fences. The village erupts, bells ring, songs are improvised, babies and elders swirl in the square. But the judge's closing remarks linger. Justice is not the end. It is the place from which we begin anew, each generation deciding what it wishes to protect and what it dares to change. In the glow of this fragile victory, another story is quietly written. Children sketch portraits of Judge Baptiste for the school mural. Teachers draft their own declarations of rights, binding oral tradition and environmental stewardship into the curriculum. Marcus, exhausted but elated, finds Grandmother Therese waiting with a flask of cocoa tea. "You pleaded well, boy," she says, "but always remember, courts are not the only place for justice. Sometimes you make your own." As evening settles, the whole village gathers in the square for song, dance, and joyous debate. A celebration of a rare reversal and a practice for battles still to come. The old colonial courthouse stands, but its walls now pulse with new stories, voices, laughter, and legacies stretching far beyond the letter of any law. Chapter 19, Return, Reunion, and Remaking Home. Part 1, The Call from Afar. The wet season brings sudden downpours and anxious anticipation. Along the coast, phones ping with messages, letters arrive in battered envelopes, and video calls glitter behind raindropped windows, signs that the diaspora is preparing to return. After years, sometimes decades, sons and daughters born into migration plot journeys home. A funeral to attend, a land dispute to help settle, a festival missed too many times, or simply a yearning that outpaces fear. Lena, working nights as a nurse in London, receives a voice note from her grandmother. "Kane is ready, child. No better time to taste the sweets of home." The message stirs a hunger sharper than nostalgia, an ache for lost faces and the world mapped in her mother's bedtime stories. Her cousin Alain, a social worker in Montreal, joins group chats to coordinate the return. Family arguments ignite quickly. Who will stay at the old house? Will the city people dress for the country heat? "Don't come back empty-handed," Aunt June warns, half in jest, half in memory of generations who sent barrels of goods but bore the expectation of never truly returning. Part 2, The Journey Back. Airports thrum with the accents and anxieties of return. Baggage carousels overflow with tins of Milo, winter boots, old photo albums, and glistening gifts. In the arrivals hall, reunions blend laughter, tears, and the careful negotiation of old wounds. Lena is embraced so tightly by her grandmother that for one trembling moment, time turns back. The years in England slip away and she is, again, someone's child. Changing landscapes shock and amaze. Hills resprouted where a banana grove once grew. Roads widened yet pitted. A once tiny town now booming with shops and hope. The first breath of mountain air burns with sweetness and unspoken ghosts. At her first family meal, Lena registers familiar and foreign tastes, hybrid curries, imported cheeses, alongside saltfish and callaloo. Great Uncle Felix, back from Brampton for the first time in a decade, tells stories stitched with longing and gentle boast. Canada cold so deep your teeth forget to chatter. Here at least, the mango warms you inside out. Part 3, Bridging Islands and Oceans. Reintegration is not always smooth. Younger relatives bait Lena about her foreign walk and posh accent. Elders quiz Alain about jobs and prices up north. The homecoming stirs pride, rivalry, and sometimes envy, as those who stayed remind the returnees that survival has its own reward. The church service for the ancestors is packed. Returnees marvel at renovations, the proliferation of smartphones, the updated hymnals. Pastor Paul, whose sermons Lena used to find tedious, now preaches about belonging, forgiveness, and the courage to reclaim what distance has strained but not broken. Days unfold with reunions and surprises. Cousins grown tall, elders frail but fierce, family recipes revived as everyone claims to have the true method. Lena helps update birth records, collects oral histories for her daughter, and hesitatingly joins a dance rehearsal for festival, learning steps slower than she remembers, faster than she expected. Alain treks inland to see the land his great-grandfather fought to keep. The reunion is bittersweet as he finds boundaries redrawn, but neighboring families welcome him as kin. Part 4, The Old and the New. While some embrace return, others find home is not as they'd hoped. Modernization has brought new wealth and technology, but also stark inequalities, land speculation, and uncertainty for small farmers. Alain sits at the edge of the market and listens to his aunt and her friends debate prices, broken promises, and a new hotel's rise on old plantation fields. Lena visits her childhood elementary school and offers to teach a first aid workshop. Her English medical training is welcomed, yet she senses skepticism. Outsider status clings, even with shared blood. She learns quickly to mix her knowledge with reverence for local ways, herbal remedies, family nurses, the hands-on wisdom that saved generations before her. Both cousins join in the Harvest Festival's planning, merging WhatsApp groups and town crier announcements, introducing a scholarship fund for village youth, and even pairing up with local artists to teach digital storytelling. Their return is not just a visit, but an act of remaking home, a pact to keep the past alive while honoring what it means to belong, to contribute, to never simply observe. Part 5, Keeping the Fire. The final night of reunion, families and neighbors sweep the town square clean, string lanterns across mango trees, and serve a feast that blurs old and new. Ackee and saltfish, curried goat, vegan pepper pot, chocolate cake, coconut ice. Dancers draped in kente and denim twirl as steel pan crescendos under the same stars their ancestors wished upon. Lena and Alain stand beside their grandmother, watching the youngest cousins present a skit about crossing oceans and not forgetting their roots. Tears flow, laughter erupts, music and prayer intermingle. The diaspora has come home, not just as guests, but as keepers and creators of legacy. When the bonfire is lit at midnight, Lena tosses a paper into the flames, a list of losses and regrets, a promise to return not just for herself, but to build a bridge for the next generation. Alain carves his initials, and those of the ancestors, into the trunk of a breadfruit tree, then hugs his grandmother so tightly she gasps and then laughs. As the song rises, the old anthem paired with a new refrain learned in another tongue, the line between home and away dissolves. Spirits are invoked, family grows. Through every return, every departure and arrival, the Caribbean continues to tell its story. With each reunion, the legend deepens, and another untold tale becomes a promise for tomorrow. Chapter 20, New Dawns, Dreams, Inheritance, and the Next Song. Part 1, Sunrise Over the Archipelago. The first rays of light spill across the islands, tinting roofs, hills, and harbors in gold. It is a morning unlike others, the kind that feels weighted with both memory and promise. As elders and little ones stir, communities across the Caribbean prepare for the Festival of Legacies, an event dreamed up by returning diaspora, local teachers, and grassroots organizers in the wake of so many battles and reconciliations. Across the archipelago, schools cancel classes. Neighbors carry platters to the square, and buskers ready their stories and songs. In Marie-Louise Village, word passes by mouth and message. Today we mark not just what we've survived, but what we will build. The bells peal, not to summon, but to welcome. Part 2, The Gathering of Generations. Under white canvas tents, people old and young cluster, eager to share, to learn, to plan. Grandmother Therese, cane tapping the stone, greets Lena and Alain, beaming at the table of family trees and land maps overlapping generations and continents. Nearby, the children show off videos of story nights, digital herbariums, and dramatizations of Carnival's midnight origins. Auntie Bev stands with Paolo and the Environmental Club, leading a seed exchange. Vetiver, cassava, pigeon pea, heirloom yams, packets labeled by both scientific name and ancestor. Leonie's daughter, Naya, feathers in her hair, marshals a dance troupe through a rehearsal, their choreography blending masquerade moves, stick-fighting stances, and routines their great-great-grandmothers taught by firelight. Panels and workshops pepper the day. Youth activists swap protest tactics. Market queens debate fair trade and climate change. Griots recount the lost names restored in the past decade. The spirit is reciprocal, listening without dominance, teaching without shame. Part 3. The Time of Reconciliation. By midday, a hush falls for the story circle. Under the Samayan tree, Sacha, Griot Emeritus, invites elders and returnees to share their truths and regrets. Maud recalls the exiles who never made it home. Let us name the lost and dance for them now. Marcus and Judge Baptiste join in, leading a reading of new declarations, blending oral tradition, environmental pledges, and rights claims drawn from hard-won court victories. Lena confides her fear. Will my daughter belong here, or always be a traveler? Sasha reassures, home is not only geography, it's the story you carry, and the one you teach others to carry on. In circles, youth and elders exchange memories, recipes, lullabies, no translation needed for laughter and tears. Music rises. Emily's violin joins a rhythm section. Local rappers improvise verses in patois, English, French, and Spanish. Dancers invite strangers into the ring. Old poetesses toast rum on the ground for ancestors and future kin alike. Part 4. Seeds of Tomorrow. In the afternoon, attention turns to the new garden, a patch of community land where children plant seedlings for each major lesson learned. Paulo narrates, "This is for the forest, this for the lost language, this for every court battle won or lost." Teenagers record it live, promising to track the tree's growth as a testament to legacy and survival. The festival's grand dialogue brings together community leaders, government officials, returnees, and elders. No podiums, only a wide circle. Debates are robust about investment, conservation, migration, justice, and the meaning of progress on their terms. Old boundaries, colony and state, planter and worker, local and foreign, are named, examined, and reimagined for a future where no one is silenced or erased. That evening, the first Islands Accord is signed, calling for the protection of community land, the preservation of mother tongues, the celebration of cultural fusion, and the right of every child to inherit stories and seed. Part 5. The Last Song, The First Light. Night comes, but the celebration continues. Torches flicker across the square, shadows leap on the murals, and the courthouse pillars now inscribed with new names. Musicians from every generation form a single improvised orchestra. Steel pan, djembe, violin, bamboo flute, the banjo, and the grand drum. Children take the lead in song, their verses echoing earlier chapters. We are the rhythm and the root. We are those who stay and those who return. We honor the broken and mend with music. As the bonfire blazes, Lena and Alain stand side by side, knowing the journey is ongoing. Each reunion, another beginning. The elders close the night not with goodbyes, but with new stories entrusted to the next keepers. Celeste leads a parting blessing. Remember to remember, and teach your hearts to sing of home. At dawn, as the first ferry rounds the coast, and the birds turn their chorus upward, the Caribbean, a mosaic of legacy, defiance, and hope, ushers in another day. The untold stories braid into the living rootwork of the islands, seated anew each time a drum is struck, a tale reborn. A child chooses their place among the stars.